Everyone, you're listening to Backstory. Let's hear it on Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee with Roberta McCulloch Dews. Thanks for tuning in. So today we are in for a treat because we are welcoming back for part two of our conversation with noted historian and educator Dr. Frances Jones Sneed, the backstory of a few historic locations in Berkshire County. And the last episode, I should say, we actually took a journey through Pittsfield and Dalton, and we got a little into Great Barrington, where we touched on W.E.B. Du Bois National Historic Site. And we're actually going to return back to that location because we just got started. So, Dr. Jones Sneed, I want to thank you so much for coming back to Backstory to talk more about these locations. And I just wanted to see if you could just give a quick recap of where we started with the W.E.B. Du Bois National Historic Site so we could really get into that conversation.
Okay, the National Historic Site is, we call it Du Bois's boyhood home site because it's the site that his ancestors, the Burkharts, started in on Egremont Plain and had come down through generations from the Revolutionary War all the way through the Civil Rights period. And Du Bois loved this site so much. He and his mother lived there. Of course, his mother was born on this site and came back after when Du Bois was about 2 years old to live for several years. And so his time there on the site and his mother's reminiscences about the site was very, very important to Du Bois, and he wrote about it in every autobiography that he wrote. He wrote three autobiographies, and he also talked about it in his most famous work, The Souls of Black Folk. So this site actually becoming a National Historic Site is a really important celebration and commemoration of not only Du Bois's life, but the longevity of his ancestors in the Berkshires. And that tells a kind of a long history of Black presence in the Berkshires. And so there are a number of sites like this, but Du Bois being world famous, you know, I think it's really kind of important. And sometimes it's when people write about Du Bois, they use the Berkshires as a kind of a postcard kind of setting about, you know, this is where he was born and this is where he lived. But I think that people sometimes treat this connection as kind of a charming biological details, but it's more than that. And I think that that's the story that we want to tell about this site. And I think we talked about it. I talked about my personal feelings about the site and how sacred I think this site feels when you walk that 5 acre space, which is like a horseshoe starting out, and it's been signage is there from UMass's public history department that guides you through Du Bois's life, which is really, really great. But just being on that land where his ancestors were, you get this kind of really kind of holy kind of spirit as you walk that. And especially in the spring and the fall when you smell the pine and you hear the sounds of the place, and you could just imagine Du Bois and then going back and reading his essay called The House of the Black Burkharts, that you can actually visualize him being on that spot. So that's one of the reasons why I think that that spot is so effective.
Why do you think that it occupied? You mentioned that the perspective that sometimes it was almost like a footnote to some, his relationship to Great Barrington. Why do you think that others would take that approach in terms of thinking about his birthplace in this way?
Well, I think they, you know, because Du Bois is known for, you know, his involvement with the National Association for the Colored People, NAACP. He's known for that. He's known for his broad intellectual thinkings about Black folk, the souls of Black folk, Black Reconstruction, the Philadelphia Negro. We could go on with the works that he has done, his work at Atlanta University, his work at with the Pan-African Association, the link between Blacks in America and Blacks on the African continent, as well as in the wider diaspora. So he's known for so much, that I think that that's the reason why his birthplace is taken as kind of a footnote. But he explains in almost all his autobiographies, as well as The Soul of Black Folk, that this is the root. I mean, this is where he learned most of and got to thinking most of his thinking. He goes back and he credits the Great Barrington Experience with finding out who he was. This phrase about being part this and part that, and this double the his phrase on double consciousness, that came from his time in Great Barrington, although he only spent 17 years there. From the time he was born, and in 17 he left to get his education, but he continually came back to Great Barrington. In fact, we talked about last time that in 1928 the NAACP deeded his boyhood home site, the one that we are talking about, the National Historic Site, to him as his 60th birthday present. And so because he always talked about it, and he always wanted to reclaim that property because it had left the family in certain circumstances. So he had a love for the place, and he kept coming back. And so I don't think it should be a footnote. I think it should be underpinning for everything else that Du Bois became.
Well, that's a good, that's a, actually, it's a great segue to talk about the Great Barrington Experience that you mentioned. And I'm curious that, again, you speak to the root, the foundation. What was that like for him, in terms of what he revealed through his writings, talking about the community, the Black community that existed at the time in Great Barrington? What did he say about the people who lived here at the time?
Well, what he said was, when he was growing up, the Black population in Great Barrington probably is about the same as the Black population in Great Barrington today. It was very small. But his ancestors date back to just the beginning of Berkshire County, coming across the New York line into what would become Massachusetts, coming with their enslavers who were Dutch. But his great-great grandfather was in the Revolutionary War, and that's how he gained his freedom and then gained the property out on the Egremont Plain. So his story goes, is a long story. When he was born and he was growing up, that was after 1868 was the time of Reconstruction, and then coming down, there was a lot of migration of Blacks from south to north, escaping kind of enslaved areas that they had lived one way or the other. In fact, he was born on Church Street in a house owned by an ex-slave who had come to the Berkshires and bought property and had two buildings. And so his mother and father rented a space from an ex-slave person, and that's where Du Bois was born. And so when a lot of them came, they were not used to the kind of area. And so that's when they founded their own church. And Du Bois became a quote unquote correspondent to their sewing circle. And he was really adept about political issues, and he wrote about political issues and what Black people were thinking about during those times in Great Barrington. And he wanted them to become involved in the political story of the town itself. To kind of break those kind of mental chains that they had about, Blacks and whites, and be really can become involved. He thought that the place gave him a lot of freedom, but he understood that he was Black. I mean, he came to the realization that he was different, right there in Great Barrington. And though he had more freedom than, say, Booker T. Washington did, who was enslaved in the South, he understood that his freedom came at a price that made him kind of different. He was the only black person in his class, in his high school class, and he graduated as the valedictorian of that class. And his thinking and his intellect said that he wanted to be better than all of them, you know. He said he wasn't a great athlete, but when it came to math and when it came to literary works and when it came to other kinds of things, he was better. And he proved that by becoming valedictorian of his class, you know,
I
so.
have another question about the schooling part. So that's presumably on the high school level, right? But then when we think about elementary school, was it integrated as well?
It was integrated, but there were so few blacks in the area. That's number one. And number two, a lot of children did not get a chance to attend school because they had to work and support their families, right? So Du Bois had a privilege that his mother, you know, allowed him to attend school. She wanted it and encouraged him to attend school. And I think that Du Bois and some later writers said that there may have been one black boy in a class, two classes ahead of him, and maybe some below him, but in his class, he was the only one. And so you would find maybe single or maybe only two black, you know, children per class. I mean, that's how sparse, you know, the education was, even though it was quote unquote integrated, you know. And in other areas, say in Sheffield, they wanted to put Sheffield at that point in time had a lot of larger black population than Great Barrington, and the town fathers wanted to have a segregated school system for black children. And so it was a real pincher of the black population said no. And for some reason, the supposed schoolhouse for black children accidentally burned down, so that never came to fore. So that's another story, though.
That's another interesting story.
Yes, that's
Huh.
another interesting story. Yeah.
So it seems that I'm trying to picture in my mind the community at the time, the community that he was growing up in. So it was small, it was nurturing. It seems like people were, would it be fair to say that people were politically minded? Were they, I feel like at the time there was, in terms of thinking about that time period, there was a feeling of trying to ensure that there was this great representation, right? There was this great representation of Black people, especially coming out of the time of enslavement, trying to ensure that others saw the best of them. And so would you say that in Great Barrington that occupied sort of the majority of thinking, or would you say that the Burkhardts sort of were trying to help move others along with that mindset?
I think that the word that we would use for whites in Great Barrington at that time is the same word that we use today, is progressive. There was, I think, a majority of them had progressive thinking. But still, there was a closed society for blacks, including the Burkhardts. The Burkhardts farmed. A lot of blacks farmed, and that's the way that they made a living. Others had their own businesses. It was really hard for them to break into the factory system, you know, that was happening at that point period of time, to get employment. In fact, in the factory systems and things like that. I mean, the Irish and other ethnic groups were coming in, and if blacks had any problems with anybody else, it was really the new coming immigrants that was coming into the area, you know, looking at you know the you know working class jobs, essentially, that they would have to compete with blacks with. But in Great Barrington, most of the blacks in Great Barrington had their own businesses, or they farmed,
Where I'm curious, where was it ice, was it in, incorporated in a certain section or?
No, it was right there on Main Street. I mean, there was a cleaners there that, that was the only a cleaners in the area. There were caterers, for food. There were tea shops, blacks tried to find, the areas that they could come into that they could really kind of do, and they fill those kind of spots, and so they were used by both blacks and whites. Others, like Du Bois's mothers, they worked for the white elite in their households and things like that. And so that's how they kind of made a living one way or the other. So it seems that African Americans in the Berkshires, no matter where you talk about, they were entrepreneurial. That's what I like to call them. They tried to find spaces that for themselves, even though that they could not be hired or were not hired by the GEs of the time or anything like that, they found little niches that they could, go into so that they could feed their family and that they could be self-sufficient in that kind of way. And I think the Burkharts are prime examples of being, entrepreneurial in that way. Out there on the Egremont Plain, blacks also owned property, and made a living from that, from what they kind of gathered from that land. But even in the Mehewe Cemetery, there is a section of the Mehewe Cemetery that's called the Negro Plots. So you could see that although there were progressive thinking and anything like that, there were certain, little signals, Du Bois's famous story about, the calling card that this young white woman would not accept for him. That is the beginning of his double consciousness kind of feeling, it hurt his feeling because he said this is when he understood that he was different, but he played with all of the boys in the areas. Their fathers were very rich and coming. He played in their households and were friends with them, so it's a very interesting but different kind of story of kind of growing up. And so
It's so interesting, Dr. Jones-Sneed, because I think that what you're what you're describing, it's sort of integration with boundaries, whereas perhaps in the South, it was maybe more clear, right? I don't, you describe the playing in the house and the all of these things and going to school, and I'm thinking again about that time period specifically, and you juxtapose that community and you put that community somewhere in the South at that same time, and the experience would be vastly different. So in many ways, Du Bois, he had, even though there are the boundaries, he had the privilege.
He had the privilege and he had the support of his family, because they wanted him to be educated. His mother especially wanted him to be educated, wanted a different life, I think, for him than, she had for herself, because, she had to re raise him on her own as a single mom, and I'm sure, she wanted more for him than that. And she died, just after he graduated from high school. And so, that was a real kind of blow to Du Bois, because he talks about how he supported his mother with the little jobs that he did, writing the newspaper columns, doing the grass for somebody or something like that. He had jobs that he did as well. So, it's a kind of a very interesting kind of picture of Du Bois that I don't think that we often talk about.
I think most times most people think of him as the scholar that he was. And so you think about him in this sort of regal setting and mindset, but everyone has a start. And going back to the foundation and the role that Great Barrington played in his life and the community at large, all the things that helped to shape and his focus. I'm curious, you mentioned something that I thought was noteworthy about the entrepreneurial entrepreneurial mindset among the people. And I'm wondering, were they also able to access the capital that they needed? Because you mentioned cleaners, you mentioned a tea shop, you mentioned all these things that require money and also the property aspect. And so, would you say that, again, because there was this progressive mindset, that the community at the time was free, freely doled out loans to folks of all backgrounds?
I think so. And it was going back to the Samuel Harrison kind of thing. You would have to have good relationships with town fathers or the people who were the money people within the town. You would have to have a good reputation, in order to float a loan one way or the other, so indeed, they needed a connection to the white power structure in order for their businesses or anything to kind of survive one way or the other. And the people who had, the cleaners and the others kind of thing, when you read their obituaries in the paper, I mean, the entire town has, says something good about them. Not only the black community, but also the white community, realized that, whatever they were doing, it was for the good of the community and not just, for, any kind of purpose one way or the other, So yeah, they had to have good relationships with the whites within the area. Yeah.
So, Dr. Johnson, you are, you know, this is, I know W.E.B. Du Bois is a, it, that's, this is, he is a passion of yours. For the individual who may not have such a deep understanding, what would you recommend in terms of, there's the tour, obviously, but in terms of learning more about him and learning more about the community that he lived in, what would you recommend as some reading that folks could get started to learn more?
I would say that I would start with chapter 14 of of his famous work, The Souls of Black Folk, because that is the chapter that he talks about his love of Great Barrington and how the sorrow songs or spirituals became such a moving kind of thing. The Souls of Black Folks has 14 chapters. Each chapter begins with a line, a line from a spiritual, right? And that's going back to enslavement and how important that song was to the black soul, right? To the black spirit. And Du Bois, he was so enthused by this whole kind of thing. That's the reason why he includes this. And he talks about how he learned this song or a piece of this song on his grandmother's knee, and it was it's African in origin, and he was never able to really go back and kind of tell exactly what part of Africa it came from, but it was so important for him that he included it in this chapter, in talking about that. And so he not only talks about himself and growing up in Great Barrington, but what a art that black people have and how essential he thought black people were for America, that America would not be America, he felt, if it were not for black folk. And so I think that that chapter really, portrays that. And so it gives you a little bit about Du Bois, but it gives you a lot about why it's important to be black in America, So, and I think at this point in period in American history where we are today, that pride in that kind of way, I think it's essential, especially to young people, to know that it's great being black, so
Yes. Yes. It, there's I, and And central to that is the history, right?
Yes.
Knowing history, and knowing it for yourself, right? Because and there are so many resources out there. That's why I specifically asked you that, because no longer are there boundaries. I mean, literally, we're walking around with little computers, right, in our hand. There's no boundary and no barrier that prevents us from learning if we want to. And so the information is out there for everyone
They,
to
yeah.
understand.
Yeah, they can take down signs, they can take books out of the library, but we've been here, we're gonna be here, nothing can kind of take away. The town of Great Barrington actually has a walking tour of black sites that you can
Okay.
go to the town website and you can upload it on your phone, on your smartphone, and you can do your own walking tour if you want to do that. But
That's perfect.
yeah, and it's narrated by my son. So I'll give him a plug.
Well, thank you for that. And you mentioned the lyrics that W.E.B. Du Bois had included in Souls of Black Folk, and it made me think about before we completely left this area and headed down to Sheffield. It made me think about James Weldon Johnson and writing the lyrics of "Lift Every Voice" in that cabin.
I'm not sure that James. I'm not sure that that's historically accurate.
Okay, so that's what we keep hearing. So tell us the
I'm
truth.
not sure that that's historically accurate. He wrote what James Weldon Johnson wrote was A God's Trombone, which is a book of
Okay.
poems. Let's see, the one when I was growing up in segregated schools in Mississippi, we were required to memorize
Yeah.
some of Johnson's poetry, and God walked out on space and he said, "I'm lonely, I'll make me a world." That's from God's Trombones. And he wrote God's Trombones in Great Barrington, in that cabin, but it was not Lift Every Voice. Lift
Why
Every
does
Voice.
that come continue to I feel like it's one of those pervasive narratives that people like myself, I heard it, and here I am running away with it thinking that it's the truth. So thank you.
We have no proof that he wrote "Lift Every Voice" in that cabin, but we do know that we go back and look at his narrative, and he talks about that he did write God's Trombones there.
Okay.
And so I think Craig Wilder, who was a trombonist,
Yeah.
performed God's Trombone, I think two or three times here in the Berkshires. And I think that the owners of the Johnson Cabin is trying to get him to come back and do another
Okay.
performance of God's Trombone, which I think is really kind of educational for us to kind of look at that in that way. And just it's a Dover Thrift. There's a Dover Thrift, and I think it's like $5. You can get a copy of
Okay.
God's Trombone, and you can pick it up and read all of those poems and things like that. So I was hoping that the NAACP would probably do in April, which is poetry, poetry month, that we probably could do something like that with high schoolers, so that they would know that.
Well,
Here in the Berkshires, this is what was happening. We'll see.
I think that one, thank you. Because this it's it this is why conversations are so important, and this is why it's so important to hear the accurate narrative. Because I tend not to hear as much about God's trombones than I hear, you know what I mean? And so now my interest is truly peak to really understand that connection. And I think that that's really important. So one, thank you for that. But I saw images of the cabin, and it's such a tiny, tiny little space there,
Yes,
nestled right in the woods.
I've actually been in that cabin like three times now.
You've been in it.
Yes. During the summer, they open it up for visitors, and was given a tour, and I walked in, and there was a copy of God's Trombone, and so I picked it up, and I turned to the poem that I said a little bit of, and I started reading, and I was with a group of about 50 people, and so and then we did a call and response of that poem, and it was so it was like walking the path of the boyhood home site of Du Bois. It was so spiritual, and I said, oh my God, here I am, standing in this cabin where he wrote this thing, and here I am reciting this thing with all of these people. So it is just so great. It was just so great. So yeah, you have to be there. You have to go.
So now I have to go inside
Yes,
because
you
I have
have
not
to.
been inside. So I have to go
Yes.
inside. Is there anything else that we should know about that particular cabin or anything before we leave the area and go down to
Well,
Chef
the only
Gail?
thing is the connection with the Du Bois. The reason
Okay.
why Johnson was in the Berkshires in the first place is because of Du Bois. But Du
Okay.
Bois kept on talking about his love of the Berkshires. He came up back and forth, in the summers. Any chance that he got, he was talking to it. Johnson was the executive director of the NAACP, and so he brought Johnson up. And Mary White Ovington also with the NAACP, they both bought property in the Berkshires because of their connection with Du Bois. And so the reason why we get Johnson writing, God's Trombones there is because of his connection with W.E.B. Du Bois. So there you go.
I have another question for you, and this is like a trivia question. Did Booker T ever come up here to meet with W.E.B. Du Bois in Great Barrington? Did that ever occur?
No, but they did meet in Boston.
Okay.
They did meet in Boston, and but Booker T did do a tour, and he came to the Berkshires, but W.E.B. was not here when he came through the Berkshires, but he did visit the Berkshires, so because I'm
Okay.
sure he wanted to see where W.E.B. grew up.
Because I'm sure they were the best of friends. I say that very loosely.
The best of friend, the best of enemies,
Yes.
and as he said in his last interview, W.E.B. Du Bois said in his last interviews, he had nothing against Booker T. Washington. He
Right.
said they were they had the same goals in mind,
They
the
did.
betterment of African Americans in this country. And it
Right.
was just, he put it down to geography. He said because of where he was born and where Booker T was born, they had different kind of goals of how,
Right.
different kind of measures of how to reach this goal, right? And that's the same thing was true with Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. The same thing was true with Marcus Garvey and W.E.B. Du Bois. So we look at our Black leaders, and we can say the same thing for each one of them. They had different ways that they thought that we're gonna reach this golden opportunity, right? And
Yep.
so they had kind of differences in that kind of way. But in the final analysis, he says he didn't not dislike Booker T. Washington. In fact, he applied to work at Tuskegee Institute when Booker T. Washington was president there, and actually got a letter of saying asking him to come, but he had already accepted another place. So so kind of really kind of interesting a way to kind of look at it. So
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was all about the perspectives, and they
yes.
had two different perspectives. And like you said, at the heart, they wanted the same thing, but they were just approaching it from different sides of the room, right? One was coming from that side of sort of the trickle-down effect, and the other was coming from the side of, all hands sort of on the plow kind of thing.
Yes.
But I think they both meant well, and they both
Yes.
wanted the best.
And the best. And the same thing, I was reading something about Jesse Jackson, who just passed. And I know a lot of people probably has real criticism about Jesse Jackson and kind of who he was, and the bottom line is that Jesse Jackson wanted what was best for Black folk. And that's what we can say about, those other leaders as well. And so we all make mistakes as human beings, but
Right.
what we, our passion is, our purpose in life, and what we want, if it's for a good cause, then we have to say, right on,
And you have to
to
look at
them
the full
anyway.
measure of the
Yeah, the full
person, right?
measure of the man
Yeah.
or the woman or the person, and
That's
not
right.
be just picking at, this and that, especially, with people's personal lives that didn't impact what they were trying to do for the
Agreed.
larger, yeah, for the larger
Agreed.
cause in any kind of way.
Yeah, it's the full measure of the person, and I think that when you look at the scope of Jesse Jackson from just his time as a young activist and that full arch, the body of work, I always say, speaks for itself. So the body of work speaks for itself, and as human beings, we're all fallible and we all have different things going on. But I always say, look at the full body of work, and that tells the story. And on that note, Dr. Jones-Need, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR FM Pittsfield. 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
Pittsfield Community Television has relaunched our website at pittsfieldtv.org with a new design to make it easier to find our live streams with PCTV Select, where you can watch live sports, city meetings, and more. Now it's simple to find our past shows on demand and future TV schedules. You can also quickly find information on how to be a member, our upcoming training sessions, and how to donate to PCTV. Check it out at pittsfieldtv.org.
What is One Berkshire? We're the voice of the business community, promoting the region and supporting local business. How do we do it? Through marketing, networking, sponsorships, and advocacy. Whether it's promotion to travelers and second homeowners, or opportunities to network with your neighbors and raise your profile, we've got you covered. So join today. Visit oneberkshire.com. That's the number one, berkshire.com.
The preceding public service announcement courtesy of WTBR and Lee Bank.
Hi, folks. For my listeners just tuning in, my guest today is Dr. Joan Sneed, and she has returned for part two of our conversation on the backstory of some historic locations in the Berkshires tied into Black history. And so we were just in Great Barrington. We were talking a little bit about the W.E.B. Du Bois National Historic Site. We got into the cabin for James Weldon Johnson and what, in fact, he wrote there. And now we are going to take our journey into Sheffield, and we are going to go to the Ashley House. And this is the house that a woman that is no stranger to the Berkshires, by the way, by the name of Elizabeth Freeman. And so, Dr. Jones-Need, I would love for you to paint the picture of the story of this house. Of course, the name of the house is named after Colonel Ashley, who was the he this was his domain. But could you talk a little bit about the house and the people who lived in it, including Elizabeth Freeman?
Colonel John Ashley was the largest slaveholder in Berkshire County. He was the largest landowner in Berkshire County, and if not the richest person in Berkshire County, one of the richest persons in Berkshire County. So he was a very, very important man, and of course he, like a number of other rich Berkshire family, owned enslaved people. He had about 3 to 6 people within his house, and one of those persons was Elizabeth Freeman. His wife, Elizabeth Cogburn, came from Claverack, New York. And it is believed that Elizabeth Freeman was enslaved by Elizabeth's father and was given to Elizabeth and John as a wedding present. I mean, that is one of the stories of how Elizabeth Freeman gets to Sheffield. And we don't know exactly what how old Elizabeth was during that when she actually came from Claverack, New York, to Sheffield. But she must have been a young girl at that point in period of time, because she grew up in the Ashley household as a cook and you know, kind of a servant in the Ashley house. But her personality, we see later, and we are getting this story from a young woman who she helped grow up, who she was like a second mother to, and this is Catherine Sedgwick of Stockbridge, of first Sheffield and then Stockbridge. So we get most of, of our stories about Elizabeth Freeman from Catherine Sedgwick. But when she was living in the Ashley household, her name was Bet. They simply called her Bet. She was known as Bet. And we know that because when she sued for her freedom, the legal papers put her name down as Bet. And so Bet, no last name. And she had to sue with a male, because at that point in time in legal history in this country, women could not sue on their own. And so she had to have a male. And one of the males in the household was named Brum. And so the legal suit is Bet and Brum versus Ashley. And because John Ashley was so important in Berkshire County economics, as well as politics. You know, he had a lot, you know, they always would have a lot of meetings at the Ashley House. And so before the Declaration of Independence, towns were going around and they were putting together their own kind of declarations. And so did Sheffield. And one of them was called the Sheffield Resolves. Mm-hmm. And so it seems that the Sheffield Resolves were talked about, mentioned, and maybe even written there at the Ashley House. The story goes that Bet was serving these men as they were around this table, you know, kind of talking about these resolved, and, you know, and she heard the phrase, all men are created equal. And, you know, you always talk, you know, they talk about Black people that we have no interior kind of thoughts, you know, we're kind of like dumb animals, we don't have any. But she did have an interior thought. She said, okay, if all men are born equal, I'm not any dumb animal. Doesn't that apply to me, you know? And so this got her kind of thinking, you know, and so this was significant about enslavers. They never seemed to think that their servants or their enslaved people, they would walk around and they would say any kind of thing, and they didn't never think that this would go anywhere, because what are these people going to do with this information, right? And so, but Bet takes this information, she stores away in her brain in what my grandmother calls, you know, that she had mother wit, you know, she had this kind of thing. I mean, she was illiterate because unlike Phyllis Wheatley, whose enslavers taught her to read and write and she became a famous poet, the Ashleys did not teach any of their enslaved people to read and write. So Bet could not read and write. But she had mother wit, as my grandmother said. She had that kind of resolve that she held this in her head. And then the story of Mrs. Ashley, who was really a kind of difficult and she was an infamous enslaver in that she treated the enslaved people not nicely. And the story is that whether the object of her ire was Bet's sister or Bet's daughter, we've never been able to figure out one way or the other. A lot of historians want to say it was Bette's daughter. The child had taken a piece of bread, and it was eating a piece of bread that was kind of left over. Mrs. Ashley saw this, got upset, took a red hot poker, and was going to hit the girl with it.
Unknown
And
caller.
I'm sorry that I didn't turn this off. And Bette put up her arm to shield the girl. And so the poker came down on her arm, burning her so badly that it was almost burnt, went down to the bone, if you think about a red hot poker being on the thing. And what did Bette do? She didn't cover this up. She worked with this, uncovered. And so visitors would say, "Bette, what happened to your arm?" And she would look at them and he said, "Ask Mrs."
Did she really?
This is a story, and so we know already that this woman had lots of grit, to herself. And so, I think that after so much of this kind of punishment, and after listening to what they were talking about around the table with the Sheffield Resolves, she determined that she was going to ask about her freedom. And so she walks from the Ashley, the Ashley House is in an area that they called at that time Ashley Falls, and was separate from Sheffield, right? Now it's kind of incorporated with Sheffield, but it was separate. And so she walks from Ashley Falls into the heart of Sheffield itself, which is about 4 miles, to the Sedgwick House. They lived at that point in time in Sheffield. And she knocked on his door and asked him if he would, help her get her freedom from John Ashley. And he accepted her case. And later, when she won her freedom in the Great Barrington Court, and also Ashley was supposed to pay she and Brougham back some kind of monies. I don't. We never find out if he actually pays any money to them. And when she's free, her first decision is, I want to be. My name is Elizabeth Freeman. That's where we get Elizabeth Freeman from. My name is Elizabeth Freeman. So she's no longer Bette of the Ashley household. She is Elizabeth Freeman.
I have
And
a question about that, Dr. Jones-Need, because sometimes we hear Mom Bet and we hear that name surface as well. And so is that because we really should be honoring what she wanted to call herself, which is Elizabeth Freeman? So it's almost like that whole Mom Bet, should that be retired?
I think it should. I don't know whether it should be retired, but I think that people need to know the story of how she became to be called Mom Bette, okay? And why we should not necessarily be calling her Mom Bette, because Mom Bette was used in a certain setting, right? So after she says, "My name is Elizabeth Freeman," Ashley asked her to come back to work in his household, but to be paid. She said no. But the Sedgwicks asked her to come and work for them. And they moved into Stockbridge. And Mrs. Sedgwick was very ill. And she had young children. And she eventually died. And Elizabeth Freeman essentially raised those children. Those children called her Mom Bette. It's not one word, it's two words. It's MUM, Mom,
Mom.
BETT, Mom Bette, which
Bet.
is Mother Bette. Is
Right.
that's what they called her. And so because she was like a second mother to them, or really to the younger children, they knew no other mother than Elizabeth Freeman. And so
Yes.
she lived in that household, and that is why Catherine Sedgwick, who was one of those children,
Children.
wrote about Elizabeth Freeman and how great she was, right? And so because she was called Mom Bet by those children in the Sedgwick household, I think that the surrounding community also started to call her Mom Bet, right? Because she not only was the household person who ran the household in the Sedgwick household, she was also a midwife, she was an herbalist, and so she was called on by a number of people in the black and white community at that point in period of time. And so they may have gotten the habit of calling her Mom Bet because that's what the children called her. But I try to say to people in 21st century society,
I was going to say, in a contemporary society.
this is not the Monica that we should be calling this woman when she has clearly said what her name was. She was 30 years of age when she came to the Sedgwick household, 30 years old. She had lived 30 years in enslavement, okay, as Bet. And then she named herself Elizabeth Freeman. She lived with the, in the Sedgwick household another 20 years, all right? And then she left the Sedgwick household. She had her own family. She had her daughters, she had her granddaughters. She bought land, she built a house, and she went to live with her children. So, we don't hear a whole lot about that end of the whole kind of conversation because the 10 million name projects, a project that is formed to find the descendants of the 10 million enslaved people in this country. The first descendant that they found was a descendant of Elizabeth Freeman, right? And so it had been so hard, so long, they thought, to trace this lineage of who Elizabeth Freeman was, because what did the Sedgwick do when when she died? They buried her in their family plot, and that she's right in the middle of what they call the Sedgwick Pie in the Stockbridge Cemetery. She's right in the middle, and she's surrounded by all these Sedgwick's children and folks and stuff like that. So, that even in death, they are still they still have a hold of this woman. So, what about her family? And so this 10 million
Wait,
names.
I never quite thought about that. She had her whole family. She had another family, and then in
Not another
death,
family. She had a family.
her family, right?
Her
Yes,
family.
her
Yes.
family, her
Yes.
family. But they took her back and then buried her with them?
Yes.
Okay.
So, but I'm just saying this is the paternalistic way that progressive whites, thought about these kinds of things. And so it's what Kaisi Lehman calls good white folk, so they were really trying to do their best because she had worked in their household. They loved her in their way. And so they wanted to honor her. So this is supposed to be an honor for her to be buried in their family plot. But just kind of thinking, back to Black lives and things like that. Usually Black families want to be together even in death, they want to be buried together. They don't want, their mama over there and, they're someplace else. But this is supposed to really kind of be an honor for Elizabeth Freeman to be in that kind of family plot. But her the place of the property that she owned has been, located and right next to another person that worked in the Sedgwick household, Agrippa Hull, who also was the largest black landowner, probably in Berkshire County at that point in time. He worked in the Sedgwick household along with Elizabeth Freeman, and they own land right beside each other. So how lovely is that, right? My whole kind of thing is, what should we call her? We should call her what she decided that she wanted to be called.
When someone visits the house, and I know we're running on you're running on time here, but when someone visits the house today, what story do you think it stories it might tell the visitor in question?
It has reinterpreted it since we've been working on the African American Heritage Trail and placed a marker at the Ashley House as one of the what we call the anchor sites. You know, the anchor site is the Ashley House because of the story of Elizabeth Freeman, the Boyhood Home site because of W.E.B. Du Bois, and the Harrison House because of Samuel Harrison. So we have what we call three anchor sites. And since we've been doing that since 2006, they have reinterpreted the story of the Ashley House. Not only telling the history of Colonel Ashley and his family and that kind of story, but also telling the story of the enslaved people that lived within the house, and also also the story of Elizabeth Freeman. So they have reinterpreted that, and so I think that that's what house museums and museums should be doing, is indeed telling the whole history of that place rather than, just telling the stories of the white owners of the place necessarily. So when you go there, I think that you will hear the story of Elizabeth Freeman as well.
And if there is to, as we close it out, if there's some recommended reading, if folks want to dive deeper into the woman, the full woman, that Elizabeth Freeman was, would you recommend anything?
Yes, David Levinson and Emily Piper wrote a book on Elizabeth Freeman, which is a much more academic book that gives lots of sources. There are a number of children's books on Elizabeth Freeman that are very, very colorful. And so some of them also, don't quite get the story right, but I think it's better than nothing, right? And so, and some of them are entitled Mom Bat rather than Elizabeth Freeman. But as long as parents and guardians understand and can explain that to kids, I think it's fine.
Okay. Dr. Jones Sneed, thank you
You're
so
welcome.
much for
You're
taking
welcome.
us through this tour. I feel like we've just skimmed the surface. We've skimmed the surface, and there's just so much history out there. And if you had to share one thing for folks who are curious ar about the world around them, about the community around them, what would you say is some parting guidance and advice?
Well, I think that we didn't talk about the memorial that Sheffield and people did to Elizabeth Freeman. Now in the right in the middle of Sheffield, there is this well, almost 10-foot
Yes, that is
statue
true.
of Elizabeth Freeman, and so the community has really kind of embraced the memorialization of Elizabeth Freeman, and I think that that's good. And I just think that you need to look at the local history of your own place where you are, and think about who were the people who were there, who made a difference. And that you'll find that's a kind of an interesting story. I th think about American history. American history is local history, as far as I'm concerned. If you start with the local, I think that you can understand the national picture much better, one way or the other.
Thank you, Dr. Joan Sneed. It's been, this has been so great. Thank you for taking our listeners on this journey of history and piquing their interest and their curiosity. And I do think that, you have dropped some nuggets of wisdom and of just different points and facts that I think people will take and make their own and go on their own journey. So I want to say again, thank you so much. And maybe down the road, you might consider coming back again. I
We never know, Roberta. It's always great to be with you, though.
So I
Thank you.
say thank you so much. And to my listeners, thank you as well for joining us today. You've been listening to Backstory. Let's hear it on Pittsfield Community Radio. Thanks again and have a great day.